Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. And this is Carl from Deviant Legion and, of course, Incredibly Strange Films and Film and Stuff. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Miss Rachel. Say hello, Miss Rachel.
Hello, Miss Rachel.
As always, we can expect that from her. And today, we are very, very happy to welcome to the podcast director and multi-talented Joe Bartone, who directed the new film, Everything Will Be Fine in the End, which is on Amazon right now. Joe, nice to have you with us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a real honor, actually. Yes, we're on Amazon Prime and Tubi and a bunch of other platforms, I think, now as well. So, but thanks.
Mm-hmm. Hey, and Tubi is awesome for those of you who have it because it means you can watch it for free. Unfortunately, we don't get to do Tubi on the network, but we support the shit out of them because they have such a great selection right now.
There.
Absolutely. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into film and all that sort of thing, Joe.
Well, like all things, completely by accident, I think it was Orson Welles who said, to be a director, one has to be a complete idiot, because if they knew how hard it was, they would never begin. And I think that is actually quite true. So I started out in music. Well, you know, maybe in grade school, I wrote some scripts and some plays and things, but my parents were not interested in the arts and did everything they could to make sure I didn't follow them. But I did manage to find an old guitar in a closet somewhere and had a long period of time, went to college for music, and a long period of time where I was a musician and a record producer, and I was a composer for dance departments like Brown University and Amherst College, Smith College, places like that, and their dance departments. I was always really interested in cinematic music. But as the years went on and played in a bunch of kind of cute punk bands, when you hit 40, 45 and you're writing songs about teenage lust, it gets a little creepy. So I figured if I hadn't actually become a mega star, I should probably look elsewhere. And somebody suggested, oh, you should get involved in film. They pay you twice as much and expect half the results. So I switched from music production to film audio production. Mm-hmm. And then another 10 or 15 years in that, sitting behind really terrible directors and a few good ones, you learn an awful lot watching really bad directors. You learn a ton about what not to do and how to do it better. And then it turned out, to make a long story longer, that entire period writing songs, lyrics are basically dialogue. You know, when you write lyrics, I've written hundreds of songs in my life. So when I actually sat down to start writing it, I got really lucky. I got into the WGA right away on this, my second script, because I've been writing songs for so long. So is that a pretty concise? I hope that's a good enough bio.
No, yeah, that's really concise. Now, what I want to know is, what do you learn from working with a bad director?
Yeah, that's a very good question. What do you learn from working with a bad director? First of all, you learn that most bad directors are far more concerned with the picture, the frame, the colors, the softness or the sharpness of the lens than they are with the performance or the story, to the point where they, like an actor will, maybe because the actor wasn't properly rehearsed, will read something as a joke when it was meant to be serious, will read something serious when it was meant to be sarcastic, and a bad director will miss that entirely. And as a result, since directors, we've gone away from the old 70s methodology of filmmaking, which the 70s, in my opinion, was one of the great heydays of filmmaking. We've gone away from that.
We'll be talking about that, because I agree. I grew up in the
absolutely.
70s and came of age in the 70s. Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah. Absolutely. So what basically has happened now is that directors are expected to be VFX artists expected to be editors, and the last thing on their list that's important is delivering a good story or a good performance.
Mm-hmm.
Should I continue?
That's what you learn, you know, and you took that to heart. So one of the things now, I have to admit, I've not watched the movie yet, but I've certainly seen the trailer a couple times. And there is definitely a story there.
Well, you know what? You can rent it on Amazon if you want for $2.
Oh, we're going to. There's no question. We'll be talking to you about that because I've got something that we're going to announce at the end of the show, and you may be interested.
Okay.
Okay. But, you know, you take a look at the, you know, and it's definitely a story. Now, one thing that I find interesting in what you mentioned that you were in a bunch of punk bands, and I'm looking at this trailer, and of course, when I was in New York in the 80s, I wanted to be in a no-budget group and tried to get in with Willie Lunch and that whole crew and Richard Howell and such. And it's very, very – it reminds me a lot of, like, Liquid Sky and things like that visually and with the aesthetic that you use. So tell us a little bit about
Liquid Sky
that.
I think Liquid Sky is a brilliant film, and it's a far more, contemporary visually than my film is. But yeah, certainly, if you're referring to the kind of Linkletter or Jim Jarmusch kind of films of the 80s and 90s, yeah, that's what I'm interested in. I love those films immensely. And as far as New York goes, my band Fat Booty used to play at CB's all the time. We actually headlined there a few times, and of course Don Hills and all the places in New York. So I'm very familiar with that scene.
Okay, so what time frame was that? Seriously, what time frame was that?
When I was playing in New York, it was probably 93 through 98, around there, I think.
Okay, so that's a little late for me. I was in New York in the 80s, and I worked at Carl Fisher at Cooper Square. And so CBGB's was just about 2.5 blocks down the Bowery.
So
I spent a lot of time there and spent a lot of time at particularly a great one called 8BC, which was on 8th Street between Avenues B and C. But, yeah.
Well, for people that are from New York, they're going to love this story. We actually played CB's when Giuliani was mayor, and – he raided the club. We got on stage. We were there for one, maybe 2 minutes. We just got into the first song and rushed. The police came in, the fire department, the health department, every inspector possible came in. This is when they were smoking crack in the bathroom at CB's, and the whole place emptied out. The entire place emptied out except for two guys that were passed out drunk. So we had to play an entire show to a completely empty CBGBs. That was a memorable night for me. Thank you, Rudy Giuliani.
That's a great story. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. So tell us a little bit about the film and what it's about.
Well, the film is called Everything Will Be Fine in the End, probably because I couldn't find a better title. I wasn't thinking about it. It was actually made in reverse. I had actually written a few other films and been pitching them around Hollywood, and they said to me, well, these are great, but you'd have to direct them because they're so kind of screwball or different, and you've never made a movie. You've made some shorts, Joe, that won a bunch of awards, but you've never made a movie, and so why would we trust you? And I said, well, fine, screw you, I'm gonna go make a feature film. And I took out a loan for $26,000, and I looked around my house and I saw some props. There was a mandolin here. My wife, she didn't want. She was afraid people were going to make a mess of the house if we filmed here. So I said, "Well, what if we cover everything in plastic?" And so I wrote that into the script. And I realized I couldn't really afford a dog sitter, so I wrote my dog into the script. And I just basically took these elements and started writing the story. But and I had to find a focus for it. And I decided to make it about my ex drug dealer, Buzz, who is surprisingly still alive. That's absolutely fascinating to me because he was, when I knew him, he was in his 60s and he was already like crazy out of his mind on drugs, but he's still kicking around. And so I decided to write it kind of a, you know, maybe a little bit of homage to him, a homage to some other musicians and that I have played with in the post-punk scene in Providence, Rhode Island. And I just let the story flow because I had to write it so that it would cost no money. But let me be perfectly honest, by the way, every film costs $100,000. I mean, there are some that can cost $50,000. Phenomenal. That's if nobody gets paid. God bless you if you can do that. But you really can't shoot a movie for less than $100,000. Just food alone is too expensive. Luckily, I didn't know this. So when I started putting the film together and rolling forward, people said, gee, Joe, you're going to need some more cash. And we managed to raise $100,000 to make the movie, which is amazing. But it literally kind of grew organically out of props and bits of conversation and situations I had when I was doing a ton of drugs in the 90s.
Doing it in the 70s and 80s. So, yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Yeah, well, I got 20 years sober. But I learned a lot, and I just thought it would be interesting to write this story. So basically, it's an adventure, if for anyone who has not seen the film. It's the adventure of these three kids. Well, they're kids. I call them kids, but, you know, because I'm 57. But George is a girl, and Renka and her boyfriend Kai are kind of on-off boyfriend, and they basically are kind of aimless. Life in LA here for them is kind of has no future. The post-COVID earth on fire, scorched to earth kind of situations prevented them from really having any opportunities. But she does find one opportunity where she could rob this woman's house that she cleans. They decide to go ahead and do that. But in the process, the poor woman, she comes home and they kill her. And from that moment on, the woman is a ghost that follows them around like a puppy, watching them slowly come to terms with the consequences of their decision, of their choices. And the reason why I made this story this way was because a lot of times in film, we see people just shooting people, but we never actually see their what happens after. Unless it was like, you know, unless you shot your dad and the movie's about how terrible you feel about father relationship. But what if you just shot a complete stranger or killed a complete stranger? How would you try to move on from that? And I think I was always interested in among my friends and the punkers and the artists, they tried to have this really cavalier kind of whatever reaction to most moral dilemmas, where they're like they would pretend it didn't bother them, but yet you could clearly see that they were traumatized by it. And I always thought this was a very interesting dichotomy to represent someone that on the surface level is trying to desperately pretend it never happened, but underneath it's tearing them apart. And I thought that mm-hmm. that's enough internal conflict to drive a story. So that's what I did.
Well, it's interesting that you know, one of the words that have been bandied about in the last 10 minutes is something that me and a number of people on the network think that we've lost, and it's the sense of story.
Sure.
You know, or even, you know, in terms of there's always an overarching plot, but story is different. Story is more intimate, you know, what happens to a character when something happens and so on and so forth. So it interests me a lot. Now, Rachel, I'm just going to ask you, do you have any questions or anything that you want to talk to Joe about before we go on?
Oh, I've just been fascinated hearing the process. And, you know, you're not actually the first small budget director we've interviewed that said basically the same thing. Yeah. All movies cost $100,000. It doesn't matter. And I'm sure we could ask Vicky about that, and she would be like, yes, 100%. You know, she's we have a director that's actually part of our network, and she's finishing wrapping up a film right now. And part of the reason it hasn't been wrapped yet is
too.
Yeah, is definitely budget struggles because and pandemic struggles. with the budget and everything else. It's just, it's insanity.
Yeah. And then $100,000 is what some commercials spend on Crafty. I mean, I've been on commercial sets for 3 days that burn through $2.5 to $3 million in 3 days. It's incredible. You know, so for the, but for the indie filmmaker, if you can get $100,000 together to make a film, then you're doing great. But here's the funny part. You're going to really find this very amusing. So the returns on these films is only hundreds of dollars. I have one friend whose film has made $14. You know, part of that is the quality of the film, but I would say 95% of that is that the filmmaker has to do his own marketing. And,
right.
You know, after you write it and produce it and direct it and edit it and score it and get it to festivals and get it out to distributors and get it out to platforms, then you have to become a marketing agency. And no one's paying you for that because there's, no one else is going to market the movie for you.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's very hard, yeah.
You know, this is why we focus on our micro-budget directors in terms of, you know, you're being independent means you do everything, right?
Yes.
And that's really what it is. Now, generally, you know, you might have a family of people in terms of, you know, a cinematographer you work with a lot who has his own equipment and that takes care of some of the budget and such. But seriously, the main thing I want to focus on is distribution, because most of my people, particularly the first timers, don't really understand the process of getting distribution. So if you can go into that a little bit and how did you hook up with Amazon and such, that would be a good
thing. Yeah. There is some, if you want to talk about that, this, you know, and this is also true across all art platforms, whether you're a painter, a sculptor, whether you're a musician, a writer of books, a comic book writer, it's the same issue is how do you bring it out to your wider audience? And one of the problems with film, one of the big problems with film, as opposed to, say, an author or a painter or a musician, is that the process of making that one work of art can be 18 months, whereas as a composer, you could knock out with modern technology an album in 2 or 3 weeks if you were particularly prolific, or even at least 2 or 3 months. Same with a book, and you can have a new thing every few months. But with film, it's a much longer process, and, you know, some of us can do it in 6 months, and that's great. But for the most of us, it's about a year or so, maybe 18 months before we get it to market. And the reason why this is important to discuss is because by the time we get to the point of distribution, we are emotionally exhausted by our own film. Because, there's the film in your head, there's the film you shoot, there's the film you edit, and then there's the film you put out. And they are four very different films. And certainly the film you had in your head looked like the Ten Commandments. But the film that you got in the can, but the film you got in the can is the best you could do. And unlike music, you don't have the option of not releasing that song because it is literally the only piece of art that you've made in the last 18 months. And you have seen it so many hundreds of times. There is this ennui. There is this incredible desire to be cut, to be severed from your movie. And I think this is why a lot of filmmakers fall into these terrible distribution deals. This is where they keep pushing. And distributors know it. Distributors are sitting out there hungry, knowing that these people are exhausted. And if I just give them anything, they'll give me the whole movie if they would like to. Why was I lucky? Because my wife, no matter how much I bitch and moan, won't let me cut corners. And because as the offers came in and they weren't great offers, she was saying, say no, do it yourself. Well, but they're going to do the market. You do the marketing. They're going to make the trailers. You do the trailers. I'm tired. I can't do it. You're going to do it, Joe, because if you don't, if you leave all the marketing up to these distributors, they will take every dime from you. That's why I used Film Hub. And also, on this very other note, a lot of distributors said, we love your movie. We're going to give you like a token up front, you know, $1,000 up front or something. We're going to give you a token, but you have to cut the sex scene. We don't want to have any sex in it. And the reason why they don't have any sex in it is not because the sex is vulgar to them. The reason why they don't want to have any sex in it is because they don't want to be bothered. Because distributors, by and large, are selling hundreds of hours of content. We've got 30 hours of horror this month. We've got 30 hours of comedy. We've got 30 hours of drama. And they're putting it out on platforms in bulk. They actually don't even watch the movies. But what they don't want is any one of their platforms coming back saying, oh, this one has a breast in it. You know, because why? Because that's going to take up more of their time. They don't get any more money by dealing with your film that has any kind of questionable artifact in it. That's why if there's no swears in it, if it's about baseball and dogs, you're going to do incredibly well because you are the least offensive to the market. It's no surprise to me that many L.A. film festivals have not even accepted my film. Some of them did. But Paris Independent Film Festival, which has been on for like 10 years, put us on the marquee and played us in the theaters. Because Europeans have a very different attitude to it. This film that I made depicts the rough, the gritty, the hard, broken people that I love. That in the hard, broken places of L.A., the filthy parts of L.A., the parts of L.A. no one wants to look at. That's where my movie resides because that's where my people reside. That's where I grew up, not in L.A., but in Providence. I grew up in the inner city of Providence. And you know, when you're from the inner city, you love it. You have a passion mm-hmm. for it because you know the struggle. And I wanted to show that in my film. But again, with the, you know, it's not the prettiest film. For, you know, for someone that wants a rom-com. And getting back to distribution, so this was always an effort. But you know what's funny? They told me my film would not be accepted on these platforms because of the intimacy scene, and they were wrong. It's actually on Prime. It's on Tubi. It's on all these platforms. No qualms. Why? Because the film's good. Because the talent worked really hard. They worked really hard to make it really great. I worked really hard, and the film was good. And the film can stand on its own merit. Let the audience decide. That's my argument.
You know, we talked a little bit about the 70s, and one of the things about the 70s I always felt was the people in charge, and we actually have somebody else who just came in. Just a moment. Hello, this is Carl, and we're with Joe Bartone. Who is this, please?
Hi there. This is Kent Harper, the actor.
Yay! Nice to have
you
on with us, Kent.
Woo-hoo,
doing well. Doing well.
Thank you for spending your time and consideration on talking to the amazing Joe Bartone and the film. Appreciate it greatly.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So Kent, if you really want to know a little bit about our podcast, we work specifically in terms of micro-budget directors. We want to definitely help promote the films. And I'm also part of the largest Facebook group on movies, and that's Incredibly Strange Films, with over 400,000
wow.
members. So we definitely go out there and do the best we can for you. Absolutely.
Wow, that's amazing. What is your name? I'm so sorry. I just called in, Joe.
Don't worry about it, Kent. My name is Carl Caper, and my co-host is Rachel Elaine. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, nurse.
hello, Carl and Rachel and Joe. Nice to speak with you and spend some time with you.
I am excited that you came
here
on the show. I have to admit, just like Carl, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I watched the trailer and it totally looks like it's up my alley. And Joe, of course, you've already answered my question about the plastic wrap, but I'm going to have to ask you too, buddy, like, how was it working with all that plastic wrap?
There were some difficulties. It moved around a lot and would fall, and it was, if that's what you're talking about as far as in the shooting aspect of it. But I love what Joe had done. It's so haunting. You know, with at first I didn't get it when I read like this character. I don't want to give away too much for anybody who hasn't seen it, but when I was reading the character with the plastic, I was like, oh, is this too much or whatever? But then when I saw the movie, I was like, wow, this is amazing. It's just haunting. And from I don't know what all you talked about before this, but yes, to shoot it, it was there was a particular scene where it was really getting in the way and you know, trying to fit with continuity and stuff. It was a challenge, but Joe pulled off some amazing stuff.
Well, it really sounds like it, and I mean, just from the trailers I saw, you guys look like you all three really work well together. So I'm kind of excited to see this dynamic. I mean, there's lines in there like, come on, this is my first murder. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's my kind of film right there.
Well, I will say, and you know, everybody has different opinions, of course. And Joe and I had met, I don't know how much time you want me to, I don't want to take up a lot of time, but.
Oh, no, keep going, Kent. You're doing
talk
great.
Talk as long as you want.
By the way, just so you know, Kent wrote and acted in Surveillance with Bill Pullman and Julia Armand. So I was really lucky to have Kent. Yeah.
Like, that's some bragging rights right there.
Well, just a little backstory. Joe and I had met, like, I don't remember if it was like 15 years maybe. I can't remember, Joe. You might correct me, but and I loved him, and I could tell he hadn't made his short films yet, but I could tell he was really creative. I love creative. I think there's so much art that everything's opinion based, but so much in Hollywood, I just don't try, like, it's just cliche and it's just not original. And I like the deeper. I like a lot of foreign stuff, and you know, Tarkovsky and you know, and John Waters and like the more unique kind of independent kind of art. And I've always been like that. And Joe seemed to be really in tune with that. We were like, maybe we'll work on something together someday. And we planned on it, but you know, you get busy and years go by and it's so hard to put a film together and get funding. And I had watched a couple of his shorts, you know, I was doing my thing and acting and stuff. And I go, oh my God, like he's brilliantly talented. It's like Terry Gilliam, kind of like very different. And I love different. And I'm very picky in that sense. Of course, you want to, you know, make money on more of the commercial stuff. But I was like, oh my God, why didn't you cast me in your show and all this? And then, you know, last year he said, I've got something that I want to do with you as one of the characters. And it's, you know, similar to Naked, this movie Naked. And I was in, and I just go, you know, thank you so much for, you know, I'm honored. And he got the money. He did everything so fast. I couldn't believe it. I was like, it was crazy. You know, he did a lot of the, sorry to speak for you or whatever, Joe, but he was brilliant and he set up a lot of my, at least the conversations about the characters in the movie beforehand, because as you know, with micro budget, it's, you're so rushed and he really gave me a lot of freedom. You know, my character is very unlikable, and it's hard. I've had unlikable characters, and you get a lot of opinions because, you know, it's sensitive of people and people that have been through things that maybe you're doing your role about that touched them the wrong way. And you have all these choices as an actor, like, do I want to play them like this or do I want to play it like that? And I kind of picked, I wanted to play in the extreme of a powerhouse, drug addict, jacked up, And I was like, is that all right? And he was, do it, Ken, do whatever you want. And that freedom's amazing to have. And I could have toned him down. I could have made him. But anyway, to make my point, we were so rushed that it was such a challenge. And especially for Ken's first movie.
Yeah, I remember Kent, the last day we did 17 setups in one day, 17 different complete scenes in one day. Just so, and then that was an 11-hour day, just because we were fighting against the sun. So we were working
Jesus
incredibly.
Christ. That's
yeah.
like
yeah.
superhuman
it was
impressive.
It was quite a challenge, and. But you know, he accomplished this, and this is just somewhat my opinion as well. I feel it's one of those movies like that you have to expect some people are going to like it, some people are not. Some people are going to like some of the characters, some people are going to like the other ones. And it's hard. Art is hard because it's opinion based, and I always. You know, when I'm working with someone and they don't, like a producer or something, and they go, no, I'm right. I go, I don't know if I want to work with this person because he doesn't understand it. Art is it's opinion.
Ever apologize for your art. I mean, one thing Carl and I always say on this show is, look, you guys have made a movie. So it doesn't matter if it's the best or the worst movie in the world as far as people are concerned. You've still done more than most of us, so don't ever fucking apologize for that.
Well, I'm not apologizing for the movie being bad because the movie's amazing. I'm just saying it's not going to be for everyone per se only because it's, I love Andrei Tarkovsky. I don't know if you're familiar with the Russian director. He has scenes with no dialogue where you're staring at the backs of characters' faces for 5 minutes with just the scenery going by on a train. And I love that. Now, other people don't have the patience, especially these days. They don't. I know the metaphors for it. Joe works with metaphors and underlying meanings, and a lot of people won't get that. They might feel it, they might get it and not know it, but he's really brilliant that way. And I can't wait to see what he does in the future as well, just on this arena. But no, I wasn't necessarily apologizing for it because I think it's just a thing that, like, it's going to be a very specific, and I might be wrong, everybody, like, but it's a great movie. I think the actors all did amazing. I think Joe did an incredible job of directing, and the writing is phenomenal. And it's a piece of art. You know, it's very different for these days, this day and age. And he stuck to what he wanted to make instead of bending for everybody else's kind of genres and, you know, cliche stuff and whatnot. I don't know.
To interject here, I just wanted to make the movie that I wanted to watch. And I think a lot of us here agree. It's like, they don't make movies like you used to. Well, great, I went out and made one. It's like,
I would watch that in the past. And that brings us back to something I was going to say before Kent came in. And that is, you know, in the 70s, You know, the people who were, you know, behind with the money and would give the money didn't know, you know, that was like in 68, you had all the hippies and all the counterculture. They didn't know what was going to hit. So they just basically gave money away and threw it at the wall. And if it hit, it hit. And if it didn't, it didn't. That's one of the reasons that the 70s were so great because it just had this great sense of different stories and intimate stories and very, very good things. And we've lost that in terms of a blockbuster. That's one of the reasons I love micro-budget people because they make the movies they want to make.
That's true.
Yeah.
Period. Well, I about that in the 70s too, at least in the first part, with guys like, say, Mike Nichols, you know, Nichols wasn't a camera guy. He was an improviser, and he trusted his DP. He hired a DP. Look, you're going to frame the movie. I'm gonna get the performances, and he focused on that, right? He focused on the performances.
Yeah.
And the thing that really inspired me was the guy that did all that jazz, the choreographer.
That's Fosse.
Bob Fosse, yeah. So here's a guy, he wasn't even a movie guy. He was a dancer. But when you watch the way he blocks bodies as they cross the camera in movies like Lenny, it's brilliant. And only a choreographer could do that. And that's the kind of stuff I'm always – that's why I think anyone could be a director if they lean in on what they know. Bob Fosse knew body motion. He knew how to move bodies to a space. And if you watch his movies, that's what he excels at.
You know, for me, my favorite director of that era and of all time is Robert Altman. And Robert Altman was always about character and conversation and how conversation actually happens in the real world. That's why he had the different mics and, you know, overlapping dialogue, which absolutely drew, you know, made people crazy, and even the actors. But to see that, it's the closest thing I think you see of real life on film. Seriously.
Absolutely.
I love that you're saying this, and I commend you both. I was talking about that you're spending time to you know, to get your word out, and that you love art, and that you're putting it out there, and you're spreading, you're sharing it with people, and I do want to say on a back note, really quick. It's funny you mentioned Robert Altman because I love Robert Altman as well, and I see some tendencies in Joe with his storytelling. But I was just living in Robert Altman's son's cabin. I know his son's pretty well, and his grandson's a really good friend of mine. But I was just living in his son's cabin in Tehachapi, up in like 7,000 feet up in the they'll be glad to hear what you just said. Actually, one of his sons just texted me. He's a cinematography, Bobby Altman. But Robert Altman was amazing. And you know, these are the films that will last on the shelves forever. You know, that's what I want to be involved in. The ones that get thrown to the side, even if they made money at the very beginning, more than the other movies, the art ones. You know, the ones that touch your soul and you don't know why. And this movie is about, you know, Joe was so courageous to touch on how unfair life is for some and for really all of us, because we're only here for a while and then we lose everybody and everything and go, not to be negative. But life is like kind of like Darren Aronofsky, the Requiem for a Dream, you know, like to touch on characters that just everything they're doing is just not turning out right, and the tragedy of life sometimes, or is all life tragedy, whether you do success or not, you know. Sorry, I didn't mean to ramble. I can get poetic, but
okay.
I really appreciate. But I love Joe for that. I mean, I fell in love with him throughout the shoot. He's a great friend, and I'm not just saying all this because he's a friend. I can't wait for you all to watch it, and I love that you're supporting the independent, the small budget micro films, because I'm involved in a lot of those, and it's so hard. I think that's where the real art is coming out. You know. The real art that I love, you know.
Well, good. I'm going to go back to Joe here and just give you some time, maybe to tell us a little bit more about the film, but also to let people know where they can watch it. And not only that, any websites or any type of promotion. Why don't you give us that at this point, Joe?
Sure. Well, thank you. And thank you for everyone for your kind words. The film is called Everything Will Be Fine in the End. It stars Kent Harper as Buzz and Elsa Kennedy as George. And you can see it. It's actually won, well, I'll be honest with you. It's won about 16 awards internationally for Best Feature. Ken picked one up for Best Actor. There's a bunch for, you know, best score. I did the score myself as well, coming from music. So it won a really bountiful amount of awards in these smaller festivals around the world, mostly in Europe. And now you can see it on Amazon Prime. You just type in, you go to the Prime Video, type in Everything Will Be Fine in the End, and then you'll see that there. And it's also on Tubi in, I think, believe, most countries. That's if you want to watch it with commercials, you can watch it on Tubi. And it's actually on a bunch of other platforms, too, through your Roku. So if you go through Roku and do a search for it, you can see it there as well. Currently it's doing extremely well. I'm very pleased with it so far, and I stand by my movie. I think it's a damn good film, and I put a lot of heart into the songs and music, and I know you're going to enjoy it.
Okay, so do you have anything on horizon that you're working on?
All right, also, yeah, because Small Factory Films, by the way, smallfactoryfilms.com is my company. If you go there, you can get more information about, there's music videos, and there's behind-the-scenes stuff, and there's other things. I have a couple of scripts in my pile, and I'm working on one now that we want to hopefully shoot in Arkansas, if I can get it done. We're always working, but, you know, the hard part is, go ahead.
If you guys shoot it in Arkansas, that would be amazing. That's actually where I'm from. I spent 37 years in Arkansas and just moved to Memphis last year to get married, actually. So,
I was shooting in Arkansas. It's kind of near Memphis, so I guess you're not too far away, right?
Yeah, where are you thinking of?
Oh, darn it, I'm sorry. I can't think of the city off the top of my head. Ash something or other. I don't know what it is. But one of the producers that I work with has a ranch out there. So I was originally going to shoot it in L.A., but since he's got a property I can shoot on for free, we decided to move it there.
Oh, hell yeah. And I will tell you, anything out there in, you know, like East Arkansas is gorgeous. It is just...
Oh, that's
like,
cool. Okay.
Yeah, fields
yeah,
of beauty and weird shit. Like, I have a number of series I'm doing with photography where I'm just taking pictures of different, like, random road signs off back roads and shit. So,
yeah.
I do a lot out there.
I love the South because, character-wise, because they're very unusual individual people that hide in a very common Southern politeness. So that veneer of Southern politeness is a mask, and behind it are all these really colorful characters. And that's a great dichotomy, you know, when you work with that literature. It's always interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, we should talk after this. I'll have Carl hook us up because I've got stories for days.
So at this point, we want to go into what we like to call housekeeping. And I wanted to let you know, I said something at the beginning when we were talking before the show that you might be interested in. So... as I said, we've done a lot of micro budget, and on Wednesday we are going to have our first film commentary watch with the director. So Mark Hero, who is a film director, been doing it since the 80s with films like Death Row Game Show, and also one of my favorites, Nudist Colony of the Dead, and Rex Tuma. We are doing Pride Month, and so Mark is going to be on, and we're going to be doing a commentary watch of his film, which is very appropriate for Pride Month, and that is Curse of the Queer Wolf. So we're going to do that on Wednesday. On Friday, we're going to be doing Alfred Hitchcock Presents. That's the Cathode Ray Mission. That's the show that's hosted by Adam Ferenc. And I'll be part of that group talking about that wonderful program that I grew up with. On Saturday, we have a Carl's Tavern, and I'm going to be presenting more new music to pack your ear holes. I was just basically gifted YouTube Premium, and I have been going crazy about finding new music. It's a wonderful thing. On Sunday, we have Rockets Town Radio with TC, and that's Summertime with Lori. And then on Tuesday, a week from Tuesday, we're going to do the Pride Playlist. So that's what we're doing here on Deviant Legion. Joe, Ted, I want to thank you both for being on. Really appreciate it, man. Any last words before we head off into the wild blue?
No, I think
we got to talk. Okay, we're getting some feedback, by the way, guys. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I actually have to run into a meeting, but I really wanted to thank you all, and I was honored to do this movie, and I'm so happy that you're spending this time and this consideration that you love art, cinema, and so much, and thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate
you. Oh,
you're
very welcome, Ken. And thank you for being on. Really appreciate it, man.
No problem. You guys have fun for the rest of it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Have a good one, guys. Good night.
So, Joe, anything else before we head off in the blue?
Well, no, sir, but thank you so much. And I appreciate you're all taking the time to keep film alive. It's great.
And we'll be in contact, too, because I want to take a look at your website and anything we can do to help promote your work. All you have to do is let me
know,
man.
You see a post, just share it. You know, there you go.
Absolutely.
The thing we can do for any artist is if we see a post that we share it to our people and just say, hey, look at this. That's more than enough.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Maybe at this point we'll do a nice little commentary watch with you on everything we'll be fine in the
we'll
end.
Be fine.
Maybe do that
in a month or two once it goes through.
And listen, Joe, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, folks. And we'll see you soon. We'll see you on Wednesday with Mark Pirro and Curse of the Quarter Wolf. Good night, people. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.